I want to be the title sponsor. What's it going to cost?
I think around 10 million.
Yeah, that's a bit out of my budget.
I have the impression that we are in the place where we have to be now.
Greg had a really bad back all last week, so we caught up on your podcast with me giving him a back massage and him listening to you guys.
That's a wonderful image.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Hello, Lionel. And Daniel's Freiba's away in Berlin now, so we've been joined this week by a mystery guest, a former Vuelta winner, Dennis Menchov.
Buenos dias.
Very good. No, it's not really Dennis Menchov. Somebody guessed on Twitter that it was Dennis Menchov, but it's actually Sean Kelly. Sean, welcome.
Hello, good afternoon. Hello all.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, we're in Richmond, not far from Eurosport's HQ. Sean Kelly enjoying his rest day lunch, ham omelette, very light lunch. I was expecting sort of much bigger three course lunch, but very restrained. Sean's been out on his bike this morning in Richmond Park, dodging the rain, and we've travelled into Richmond to catch up and get Sean's thoughts on the Vuelta so far.
Well, we'll be talking all about the Vuelta, the state of play, top 10 at the moment. We're on the rest day, big hard day tomorrow, so you may be listening after that stage, but top 10 all within 2 minutes of each other, so it's a very open race. Don't really know what's going to happen, but it'll be interesting to get Sean's thoughts on that. In the meantime, though, Lionel, can we have your weekly roundup?
Well, yeah, the Vuelta a España is well and truly underway now. As you say, we've reached the first rest day. It's been a really entertaining week's racing. Lots of new names to conjure with that have come to the fore this week. I suppose the biggest story of the week has to be Peter Sagan pulling out of the race after being knocked off by a race motorbike. He expressed his displeasure at that, punched and kicked, I think, the race doctor's car, and then pulled out because of his injuries at the end of that particular stage. In terms of the racing, Sagan did get a stage win and was wearing the green points jersey at the point that he pulled out of the race. But I suppose the weeks really belonged to Orica Greenedge. Caleb Ewan won a stage, Esteban Chavez won his second stage and spent a fair bit of time in the leader's red jersey. And he eventually lost the leader's red jersey to the other kind of revelation of the week, Tom Dumoulin of Giant Alpecin, who won an excellent stage at Benitatxell, I think it is. So the Vuelta, as you say, boiling up very nicely ahead of the really difficult mountain stages. Everyone that matters really within a couple of minutes of one another. Away from the Vuelta, we've had the Grand Prix Plouay, a World Tour race in Western France. That was won by Alexander Christophe of Katusha. The women's race was won by Lizzie Armitstead, and she has wrapped up her second consecutive World Cup title with that victory. And in other news away from the racing, well, let's think what's happened. Bobby Julich has left Tinkoff Saxo, or has he? We're not entirely sure.
The question is, has he been fired? Or, the Tinkoff Saxo put out a press release to try and set the record straight, but hasn't really succeeded in doing that. He will leave the team at the end of the season.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some fairly explosive tweets from Oleg Tinkoff on a number of subjects this week. Who hasn't he offended this week?
I mean, Bobby Julich joined this year from BMC, having previously been at Team Sky, and Daniel Freib has told us a few times this year that there's been a bit of disharmony at Tinkoff Saxo over Julich's training methods. He's been a coach there, and there was a theory at the start of the year that he was training them too hard, but maybe we'll find out the real reason. I must say, Lionel, this is a bit of a change for us. Sean has come with notes, highlighter pens, looking very studious in his glasses, he's got foreign newspapers. This is a level of organisation and research that we're not used to. Certainly puts Daniel to shame, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, this is what I'm used to whenever I popped into the Eurosport commentary box. Sean and Carlton, or Sean and Rob Hatch, always have all of their notes, highlighter pens. I think they must, the colour code everything. There's a colour for everything. I don't know what the colours mean, but it's certainly very detailed work.
He's getting out his Lakeet now. One of the great things about Daniel not being here is that we were able to order whichever coffee we fancied at the end of lunch, which was nice, wasn't it?
Yeah, and we can mangle pronunciation of riders' names as we please.
Exactly. It's very liberating. But do hurry back, Daniel. We do miss you. Sean, first week of the Vuelta then. The race is shaping up nicely. It's still very open. Lionel described Tom Dumoulin as a revelation. He's obviously in the leader's red jersey. Is he a revelation to you? Are you surprised to see him in the position that he's in?
Well, not at this moment. When you look at his performance of past, meaning the last 18 months, 2 years, and of more recent, in the Tour of Switzerland this year, he was very impressive in the big mountain stages. Unfortunately, in the Tour, he didn't get far through day three. He crashed out in that huge pile-up. So I'm not surprised at all to see him where he is. The question is now, the big mountains, will he last when you have 3-4 climbs and we have a lot of days where we have enormous mountains coming this Vuelta? It all has to be done, really, for the overall winner to be seen.
I mean, he is obviously renowned as a time trialist, a very strong, big, strapping rider, but a lot of comments about whether how he'll get on in the high mountains because of his size. But I was looking at his statistics, if they're accurate. He's listed as being 71 kilos. He's 6'1", which is the same height as Chris Froome. Only a couple of kilos heavier. I think Froome was a couple of kilos heavier at the Vuelta, at the start of the Vuelta, than he was at the Tour, around 69 kilos. So he's not, you know, when you were talking in the past about big, strong riders, someone like Miguel Indurain was 80-odd kilos. Bradley Wiggins, I think, was 72 when he won the Tour. So he's not the sort of shape of rider that couldn't win a general classification, is he, Lionel?
Well, no. I think the thing is that because of the way his career progressed, he looked like he was going to be a ruler, time trial specialist. And as Sean points out with his results in the Tour of Switzerland, and more importantly, the way he rode in that Tour of Switzerland, it's not like it's a stunning, out-of-the-blue performance. I think what was really interesting was the way he rode that stage that he won, the final climb. Obviously, looked in a great position. First of all, I was quite surprised to see he was hanging in there, and then for him to go off the front of that group and then to duel with Chris Froome. Now, we know Chris Froome isn't perhaps at the same level as at the Tour de France, but to see Dumoulin just not give in and find that final burst at the line, that was really what made everybody sort of go, wow, this is unprecedented from Dumoulin. But perhaps it's just another notch up on a general level of progression that we don't yet know where that progression is going to lead to.
And the crash at the Tour, that obviously was devastating for him at the time, but ultimately it might have done him a favour. He's come to the race rested. He says he's in the form of his life. Inner Ring, the blog that we reference quite often, made an interesting point that he thought that Dumoulin and Froome rode the climb, which was a very erratic sort of climb. It steepened. It was less steep in places. It wasn't a steady gradient at all, but they rode in a similar way, and that both made a linear effort, and Froome's happened for a lot of it to be off the back, and Dumoulin was off the front, whereas the others were jumping around a lot more, and we saw Valverde, Quintana attack, and others, and Rodriguez attack as well, whereas both of them maybe managed their efforts a bit better.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask Sean about the different types of road between the Tour de France and the Vuelta. What are the characteristics of these roads? Because when we watch on TV, the first impression is that a climb is a climb, but the roads are very different and they lend themselves to different types of riders, I guess.
Yes, well, if you look at the Vuelta, I think Dumoulin, he did an excellent ride. He's in excellent shape, beating Chris Froome on that, a wall really to the finish on Sunday. But the long climbs, that's where I think Dumoulin might get into difficulty. The Spanish roads now are good surfers. They've done a lot of work in the last 15-20 years, so the roads have improved a lot. So I don't think between the Tour of France and the Vuelta roads there's not any difference. And I think this Vuelta is as difficult as the Tour. Definitely is, if not more difficult. And the riders we have, we have a huge amount of big two riders in the race this moment, and all very close together. So it's going to be a spectacular final 2 weeks, especially this third week, the second week, that is a really killer of a week. And I think it's the guys who have that little bit more energy, how they're recovering, that is going to be so important in this Vuelta, because the guys who are battling the Tour, you know, the ones there, they could have trouble, you know, the final week where the ones did not do all the Tour or do not do it at all, a little bit of an advantage.
In terms of like the two riders that we've seen really emerge this week, Dumoulin and Esteban Chavez, the one amazing thing about a race like the Vuelta is we see riders coming to the fore, certainly in the early days. It will settle down. I think the big names will come up in the second half of the race. But got a situation, you couldn't find two different physical specimens between Dumoulin, tall and thin, and Chavez, Esteban Chavez, the Colombian rider, you know, very short. What one would think a much more punchy rider. This emergence of Colombian riders, Quintana, Rigoberto Urán in recent years, Esteban Chavez and others, it's kind of the second big wave of Colombian riders, isn't it? And Sean, you were a professional in the years when Colombian riders first came over and raced in the Grand Tours. And of course, in 1987, you were dueling with Luis Herrera in the Vuelta, and what were your impressions of Colombian riders back in those days?
Well, they were great climbers, terrible descenders. You could allow them to take a minute and a half on a long climb, and then you would catch up with them when they'd be climbing back out of the ravine on the way down the other side. That has totally changed. You know, when you see the likes of Quintana, Chavez, and a lot of the other Colombian riders of more recent, they've improved as all-rounders. They can time trial, which is the important thing. We can see Quintana, he can time trial so fast for a little tiny climber, lightweight. The Colombians are certainly, you know, coming out in the last years with more and more riders, it seems to be. And, it looks like that they're going to be a force to win Grand Tours in the years to come.
In terms of their characters, Sean, Luis Herrera, who won the 87 Vuelta after you unfortunately had to withdraw with a very serious injury, which Lionel described on last week's podcast as smarting a bit, and that was your description of the pain from the saddle sore that you suffered in 87. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that, but in terms of character, do you see similarities between Luis Herrera? Was he somebody that you got to know? And someone like Quintana, they seem very quiet, humble, sort of hard-working guys. Can you see that there are similarities there?
Well, I raced a lot with Lucho Herrera, and you know, I got to know him pretty well. Fabian Parra also, very nice guys. And I was racing in a Spanish team, Cass, so I was my Spanish lingo was quite good at that time. So yeah, they were, you know, great guys. No bother having a conversation with him. It looks like Quintana is the same style of rider, and that's the way most of the Colombian riders seem to be. Of course, yeah, Lucho Herrera, he won a Vuelta that I should have won, and let's not beat around the bush. I think I had a boil on my bottom, otherwise I would have won that Vuelta and I would have two Vueltas on my palmarès.
Well, would you have come? You won in 88, of course, but would you have gone back in 88 to try and win it had you won it in 87, do you think?
Yes, I think definitely I would have been, because I remember when I joined the Cass team, when they became main sponsor, they were a co-sponsor for a year or two previous, and the big boss, Luis Knorr, said, for us, the Vuelta is the most important race of the season. You like to do the classics, we will put a team with you in the classics, but we are a soft drinks company. In Belgium, they only drink beer and eat chips, and in northern France, same situation, so... I want to do the Vuelta, and it would have been always the same for me. The Vuelta was the one that he wanted to win, and the rest came after that.
We'll talk a little bit more about your own Vuelta experiences and memories, Sean, but we'll take a little break and come back and talk about some of the controversies at the Vuelta so far.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Download old episodes absolutely free at thecyclingpodcast.com.
So continuing with this year's Vuelta, the third Grand Tour of the season, it's been an open race, an exciting race so far, but also there have been a few talking points, starting with Vincenzo Nibali's disqualification week one that was discussed in last week's podcast, where he also talked about the controversial prologue team time trial along the beach. Sean might have some thoughts on that as well, but the more recent talking point has been Peter Sagan, and his withdrawal from the race after being knocked off by a motorbike, a Shimano neutral service motorbike. There have been several cases of this year. It seems to be something that's happening with greater regularity, race vehicles colliding with riders and you know, putting them in real danger. And it was a nasty crash that Sagan suffered, and the injuries forced him out of the race, which might well affect his chances at the World Championships. Sean, do you think that this issue of vehicles colliding with riders, is it happening with greater regularity, or are we just seeing it happen more often because there are more TV cameras and so on the race? Was it something that happened a lot in your day as well?
Well, I think accidents, they seem to be a bit more this year especially. And I think at the rules and regulations, some you can plan and try and not have them. Others, it's difficult to do that. And when we talk about this Vuelta, having a team time trial on, as they say down in Marbella, Lover's Walk, I don't think it was a place to have it. Riders going at 60 kilometres per hour, that's something the governing body has to look into, and there have to be some control there. And I think the riders and the teams are a bit afraid to say anything, because then the relationship between the race organisers and the teams is not good, invitations and all of that. I think that's playing. So they definitely need to be something done about that. Also, the problem we see with very clearly with Sagan, the motorbike knocking him off. It's nothing new. I had it during my career where I got knocked off by race director's cars in the Tour of Lombardy, Tour of Holland, a number of times. And I've seen it other riders in the same situation. Now, of course, there's lots of TV cameras out there, so we see it live on air on Eurosport. So, there's more talk about it. And it's definitely something that has been looked at also. The people who are in the race, who are driving vehicles, taking a car, taking a motorbike, they have to have experience. And you have to do everything in your utmost to try and, eliminate that as much as possible. But with bike racing, and we see on Sunday when Nicholas Roach had the crash, he was getting back into the race. Team cars also, they were weaving out between team cars doing 50 plus kilometres per hour. It is a dangerous sport, and it's always going to be dangerous, but you just have to try and work on it on all aspects and try and make it as safe as possible for all.
I think, Sean, was it 1979 or 80 when you rode the Vuelta, there was a really nasty incident just after the finish line in a stage. Talk us through what actually happened and what were the consequences of that. Did the riders, protest or say anything to the race organisers, or was it just put down as one of those things that happened, an unfortunate accident?
Well, of course, the organisers, they come and say sorry. This was the car driver who was not experienced enough. And of course we see of recent the person driving the car, he's just expelled from the race, but that's not good enough.
What actually happened in that incident in the Vuelta, was it 79 or 80, one of those years?
Well, it was one of those years. It's so mixed up, so many Vueltas and so many big tours. But it was in the sprint, a flat run in, and were a big bunch of riders, I think, pretty much all the peloton, and the commissar in front of the bunch, he went through the finish line, and then it got a bit chaotic. 50 metres off the line, he couldn't continue on, he had to stop, and we came doing 50 to 60 kilometres per hour in the sprint. I remember with Noel de Jonker, and there was another number of riders, and we just sprinted the line, and then we just blocked on the brakes, and just not enough time, and we crashed into the back of the car. Someone put their head through the rear windscreen, and so I got marked for life, my left ear. I got a number of stitches here, and it took a bit of my beauty away.
That's where it went. Sagan, to add insult to injury, was then fined for his reaction after being knocked off by the motorbike. He bashed the doctor's car, he kicked it, he punched it. Did you ever vent your frustration that way, Sean? And what did you think about the fact that he was fined for those sort of understandable sort of reactions?
Well, I think if you react like that, you're definitely going to be fined. And I can understand Sagan, his actions as well, because it was in the in the part of the race where he was in a leading group after getting all the climb to win the stage, it was going to be, you know, quite looking very possibly he would win the stage. So it's normal you react like that, but the moment you react like that, the commissars are going to fine you, and I wasn't surprised that he got the fines the following day.
I mean, we talked last week, well, I didn't because I was on holiday, but Daniel and Lionel and Rob Hatch spoke last week about the Nibali sticky bottle incident. I don't know if we can really describe it as a sticky bottle incident, but I'd be interested to hear your views on that as well, because my thoughts on it were that initially I thought, when I'd heard that he was disqualified, having not seen it, I thought that's a very extreme reaction, because this is something that obviously happens all the time, and we've seen it happening on other stages of Vuelta this year as well. But it was so blatant, when I did see the footage of it, it was so blatant that the only course of action there was disqualification. Was that your view of it as well? And you know, again, is it something that you see more of now, or was it, again, quite a common thing in your day? I'm not suggesting that you ever had a sticky bottle in your hand in your life, but was it something that was common in your day as well?
Well, I'm not going to tell lies. I had a number of sticky bottles during my career, but it's where and when you have them. And we heard about Nibali, you know, being thrown off the race a number of hours after the event. And when we see the exclusive pictures from Eurosport the following day...
he's good. He's in lots of plugs for Eurosport. That's fantastic. British Eurosport do sponsor our podcast, of course, so that's absolutely fine.
But we could see clearly he was on the front of a group chasing. He was a second group on the road chasing down the group of big favourites. And he was leading. The car comes up. We could not see the bottle, but the way Nibali went away at the other side of the car from the other riders, and we could hear the other riders also reacting. They were shouting all sorts of abuse at him. The commissar had no choice, only to put him off. If he was getting back into the leading group or the second group on the road, and you're 100 metres behind or 150 metres behind, I think if you take a sticky bottle, then the commissars, considering he was in the crash and he had to wait a long time to get a bike, I think he wouldn't have been thrown off the race. There would be a fine. But when we see the pictures, there was no other way, only to be thrown out.
No, and I think, let's not be too hard-line about this. He had been held up by a crash. He wasn't cheating to win the race. He was cheating to get back on. This is a distinction that I feel is quite important, having had some history of a sticky bottle myself as well, Sean. In fact, I was once... okay, Lionel, I can see you putting your hand up there. What are you going to say?
Well, I was going to just draw to everyone's attention the fact that you're... almost illustrious racing career came to an end at the RAS.
No, I heard you say this on last week's podcast. I'd like to take issue with that. Full disclosure, I was once disqualified from Sean's national tour, the RAS in Ireland, the FBD Milk RAS, in 1996. In fact, Sean, I think the RAS went through Carrick on Shore that year, and we were riding in the bunch one day towards Carrick on Shore, and we came across a rider out in sort of winter training gear and mudguards and everything, and it was none other than Sean Kelly. You probably don't remember that, but you joined in with the bunch in the RAS, and I'm sure most riders in that situation would have been given short shrift by the commissars, but they turned a blind eye to that.
Well, first of all, in the RAS, if you got thrown off, it must have been a super glue bottle, because there, I think they tolerate a lot. So I'm surprised at that.
I think it was an anti-Scottish thing.
No, I don't believe that. I would not take that for one moment. Yes, the RAS, as you said, it's a great race, and it's a race that's going on for many years. And congratulations that you took part in it, because
I came back the next year and I did finish it with my dignity intact. I'd crashed heavily. I had a very sore knee, Sean. And I was just holding on for a few seconds, really, to get some speed up to try and catch the bunch up again. But I was 10 minutes off the back. It wasn't going to happen. So I wasn't. It was survival rather than anything else. Just to I think I was quite harshly treated, to be fair.
Well, sorry about that, Richard. I didn't have the full facts at my fingertips, but it didn't stop me offering a fulsome opinion of your
not like you, Lionel.
Indiscretion. Well, no, that's a bit unfair also. But I think just moving the debate on, I think we said this last week, that there was no alternative, because I think once you've established that is okay, then, that it's the grey line, isn't it, or the grey areas. Sean there, I didn't realise, I hadn't actually heard that the other riders had been shouting abuse at Nibali as he was pulling away from them at, you know, 0-60 in about 4.5 seconds. But that's really where the balance has to be struck by the commissaires. And I think I'm not surprised perhaps that Sean says that Peter Sagan deserved to be fined, or surprised that he was fined. But I do think that also there, you know, the duty of care for the race vehicles is to look after all of the riders. As you know, we accept that accidents can happen, but I mean, in terms of how the race has unfolded, you know, we've had sort of two really high profile controversies that have detracted a little bit from the stories of the race. We shouldn't really be talking about, I mean, the images of Peter Sagan riding along with his shorts cut open and a huge hematoma on his backside, more than a boil on his bottom, that was a real a pizza sized.
Are you downplaying Sean's injury from 1987 that caused him to withdraw from the race?
No, we'll hear about that in a minute from the horse's mouth. But the image of Sagan riding along, waving his fist angrily at the TV cameras who were, you know, zooming in on his injuries, you know, that didn't make the race look, it didn't make the sport look great, did it? It was an unfortunate thing to have happened. And then when you, at that point, we didn't know that he'd been knocked off. And I think Sean in commentary was probably he pinned his colours to the mast very early on, saying that he must have been knocked off by a vehicle simply because of his reaction. Because, you know, if that had just been a run-of-the-mill crash between riders, he wouldn't have reacted in such an angry way. It's when race vehicles get involved that the injustice of it really comes to the fore. And I think the fine was really rubbing salt into the wound.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
Competition time now. We've got two copies of Sean Kelly's autobiography, Hunger, to give away. These copies are the original hardback editions, both of them signed by Sean. In the book, Sean tells the story of his cycling career from beginning to end and covers all his major classic wins, his Tour de France green jerseys, the Vuelta a España victory, of course, and much, much more. Now, if you don't win the competition, the new paperback edition is available now from all good bookselling outlets, including that one on the internet, as well as from SeanKellyBook.com. But to stand a chance of winning, answer the following question. Ready? When Sean Kelly won the Vuelta a España in 1988, who were the riders who finished second and third overall? Now, you can answer in two different ways. Either tweet us at cycling_podcast with your answer, or, because we know not everyone does Twitter, email us at cyclingpodcast@outlook.com. That's cyclingpodcast@outlook.com. Please use the words Sean Kelly book in the subject heading so we know to look out for it, and include your answer in the body of your email. I'll repeat the question again. It is, when Sean Kelly won the Vuelta a España in 1988, who were the riders who finished second and third overall? The closing date for answers is 6 p.m. on Monday, September the 8th. And good luck. And remember, if you don't win, you can buy the paperback now.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
So you heard our British Eurosport jingle there. Thank you very much to them for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. They are exclusively showing the Vuelta live for the rest of the race with Sean Kelly and Carlton Kirby. And coming up next week on Eurosport as well is the Tour of Britain, also being shown live. So Sean, as I said at the start, it's a very open race. The top 10 all within 2 minutes of each other after a really difficult sort of opening. Looking at the standings, I mean, there are a few people gone home. Nibali is out of it. Mikel Landa, who I think we fancied after his solid Giro, he's well out of the overall picture. He obviously doesn't have another Grand Tour in his legs this year. But Chris Froome, who won the Tour de France, is up to eighth. He seems to be getting a bit stronger. He's 118 back. His teammate Nicholas Roach, who obviously you know very well, is fourth and has looked very strong as well. And I'm not sure, how do you think they are going to play it? There are sort of two teams with both with a two-pronged attack. There's Movistar with Quintana, Valverde, we've seen them working together quite well, launching sort of 1-2 attacks. I'm not sure about the situation at Sky, whether Roach fancies himself as leader, whether Froome fancies that he's getting stronger and deserves to be the leader of that team. I thought the other day when Roach went clear a little bit, Froome sort of brought him back, whether intentionally or not, I don't know. But do you have any insight, any thoughts on how they're going to play it? Team Sky first?
Well, I think both teams and are going to play both cards for the moment. And I think Team Sky, looking at what we've had in this race, Chris Froome seemed to come into the race not in the rhythm that he was in the Tour of France, certainly, but he has improved. And when you do a Tour of France as Chris Froome, as Quintana, as Valverde, and all the other riders we have here in the top 10, it's a difficult one. You have to rest up enough with Vuelta in mind, but if you rest too much, then you come into the Vuelta after resting from the Tour a little bit out of rhythm, not in the best of shape, and it can take a week to get into the rhythm again. And that is the question I am asking myself now. We see Chris Froome on Sunday, he put up a spectacular final up that real wall of a finish. If he is coming better as the race go on, well then I think he is a force to reckon with. And I think with Sky they will play Nicholas Roach for as long as possible, just in case that Froome is not in good shape in the second week, which is the week of this Vuelta.
Roach, it's a race that Roach really seems to enjoy, the Vuelta.
Always. I think Roach, if you look at his palmarès, look at his performances, he seems to ride better in the Vuelta from the time he started in his professional career.
Not like his father. I don't think his father didn't ever cover himself in glory at the Vuelta, as far as I can remember, can he, Stephen Roach?
Well, I think his father liked a good lifestyle. When the tour was finished, it was on the beach.
Well, but then in those days, Sean, I'm going to have to pull you up on that, because in those days, the Vuelta was before the tour, of course. When did it change? It was around mid-90s, was it not?
95, wasn't it? I think the first one.
He'd retired by then.
Well, we're talking about end of season.
You think he liked a good lifestyle before the tour as well? Is that what you're saying?
Never done anything after tour. He made a few appearances. One year he did the Worlds, and apart from that, after tour or season.
He did all right that year in the Worlds, I think. Now, Sean, you've highlighted a couple of names in pink, I notice, on your overall sheet. You've got Froome and Rafał Majka highlighted in pink. Why is that? Is it you have some secret knowledge of those guys, how they're going to perform?
Well, I think when you go down to Christopher Froome in 8th place, Majka in 9th after that, Pozzovivo, I'm not too sure if he's going to be a real challenger. Mikel Nieve, of course, from Sky as well, he is going to be definitely sacrificed when we get into the difficult week which is coming. So yes, it's really in the top 10. Outside of that, I don't think for the podium place, certainly, nobody is going to make any inroads there. It's all in that top 8th place, really.
And we mentioned Movistar, Quintana, Valverde. What are your thoughts on them? I mean, Quintana, they've been racing, it seems, a bit more aggressively than they did at the Tour, taking on the race a little bit more. Has that been your impression? What do you think we can expect from them this week?
Well, I think Quintana, he is my favourite to win this race. Although the last days, especially on Sunday, with Chris Froome starting to perform very, very well, very impressive. I was concerned that he was going to be tired as this race go on. It doesn't look that, but I'm still my big favourite is Quintana, and I have a big bet down with some of the staff in Eurosport that he will win this Vuelta.
It is a big bet, isn't it? One whole pint, I think your bet is. Or is it 2 pints? Double or quits? Yeah. Last of the big spenders there, Sean. But I think I'd agree with that, because looking at...
a big drinker.
The 2 pints.
Pints all he needs.
Yeah, a couple of pints will be enough. If you look at that GC, it's going to boil down, isn't it, I think, to Rodriguez, Fabio Aru, Valverde will be there or thereabouts, Quintana, Froome and Majka. I think that's... And then it's a whittling down process as the mountain stages go on. I mean, in terms of the character of the Vuelta, how it is now compared to your day, think back to 1987 and 1988, held at a different time of the year in the spring. Riders, perhaps, we wouldn't have had that phenomenon that we've got now, where you've got a number of those contenders have come out of the Tour. They've got a very difficult race already in their legs, and for some it's a bit of a consolation prize, and not in terms of the prestige of it, but for some of them it's a chance to kind of redeem themselves after the Tour de France and salvage a really big result from the season. Whereas when you were racing, it was the first Grand Tour of the three. Was it very different back in those days?
Well, it was, first of all, early part of the year, the weather wasn't as warm, of course, where we've seen in this year's Vuelta down real southern part of Spain, very warm the first week, and that's going to have an effect on the riders as we go on into the second and third week. And you know, during my time when it was in the early season, you did not get as many of the big riders taking part, although it was a very important race for all the Spanish riders, so it was never easy. It was a major difficult race to win, I would say that. But the Vuelta of recent, it's amazing the riders they're getting. If you look at last year, they were lucky because the crashes, Froome, Contador crashing out in the Tour, and they went to the Vuelta. But this year, once again, you have, you know, such a field of big three-week Tour riders. It's an amazing. It's turning out to be, you know, a spectacular race, as it has been for the past 5 or 7 years. They have shortened their stages a lot. They have, in the first days, they have these uphill finishes which go up 2 or 3 kilometres, very, very steep, and you know that makes spectacular racing. But I'm afraid this year they're pushing it a little bit too much, with the second week being so difficult. If they continue on doing that, it might be, you know, a bit more difficult to get a lot of the riders to come back. It depends how the race works out for the riders who did the Tour, Froome, Quintana, Valverde, Rodriguez. If they get through the Vuelta and they don't have any major difficulties, then they will say, well, you can do two Tours, Tour of France and Vuelta. But if they get into major difficulty, then of course the riders, the teams will start asking the questions, and to get the riders back may be a bit more difficult. But you have to hand it to Vuelta. It's been a spectacular race the past 5, 6, 7 years.
There has been a pattern as well of riding the Vuelta in August, September, actually standing riders in good stead for the following year's Tour de France. You know, it's almost like the first building block towards the following year's Tour de France. I think that we can say now that the move to August, September, which was hugely controversial at the time, has probably been quite a good move for the Vuelta. It seems to have help to establish it and its unique place in the calendar. It felt, before looking back now, although it seemed at the time that was the way that the Grand Tours came, Spain, Italy, France, it seems now that they were really packed in, and there were the odd riders who rode all three Grand Tours in those days, but I think there was only 2 weeks, maybe even sometimes only 1 week, between the Vuelta finishing and the Giro starting. Did you ever ride all three Grand Tours, Sean? Ever tempted?
No, never tempted.
You were asked to, though, weren't you, Sean?
Yes.
Sean, yeah.
Yes, I was asked. I was just going to come to that. Yes, with my coach and the team owner, Director Sportif, Jean de Gribaldi, he was more than one season he was trying to, you know, to do all three tours. And with de Gribaldi, for me, he was, you know, a very important mentor for me in my career. I think he was part of my successful career. And he did try at least on two occasions to do the Vuelta, Giro and Tour. And of course, I never said no to Garibaldi, so I would say yes, okay, we'll look at it. And I remember, you know, doing Vuelta, and then before Giro, getting this suddenly getting a pain in my knee, and that was my way of getting out of it, because I never wanted to do the three tours. But Garibaldi was a director that said, you can never get tired physically. It's only listening to the journalists and the guys who say you're doing so much races you're going to be tired. They will make you tired.
Bloody journalists.
Well, yeah, but it's interesting there, the invented knee pain to get you out of doing a race. It reminds me of some of the excuses I came up with for homework back in the school days. But tell us then, Sean, the story in 1987. You said earlier in the podcast that was the Vuelta that you should have won. You were very close to winning, I think only 2, maybe 3 days from winning the 1987 Vuelta, and then you had a pain in the undercarriage. It was this duel between you and Luis Herrera, the flyweight climber who gave everybody a lot of difficulty on the mountains, but with a time trial still to come, there was you were very confident that you were going to win that Vuelta, and I think you were in the yellow jersey when you pulled out.
Yes, that 87 Vuelta, as I said, I was in good shape, and It was 3 days before the finish. I had to pull out because I was suffering with a saddle sore for a number of days previous, and it just was getting more and more sore and unbearable with the pain. And we had a stage to Valoid, which was a road stage, and we finished there. Then we had a time trial, an individual time trial, and I took the race leadership there from a German rider, Raymond Ditson. And Herrera, of course, he was in close proximity as well in the general classification. So I felt, although I could go on and win that race, but there were difficult days. There was two more difficult days in the mountains, but I was confident. But it just got so painful, I just could not bear the pain and had to abandon.
Did you not try to lance the boil one evening with your team doctor or soigneur? Tried all kinds of remedies to try and relieve the pain. Did you? You know, did you cut a hole in the saddle so that it wouldn't put so much pressure on the painful point? Is that right?
Well, the race doctor, did drain the bile, and I had, I think it was 3-4 stitches there, and I went on in the time trial. That was before the time trial, and as I said, the following day I went to the start, did about 20k to 30k, I can't remember exactly, and just too painful to continue. We had been working on, putting, cutting a piece out of the chamois in the shorts. We had done all of that, but it just got too painful to continue. And yeah, it was after battling in a 3-week tour, the most difficult over, and being in the race leader's jersey, it was a huge disappointment.
My eyes are watering just thinking about it. Absolutely horrible. And then, but you did recover and went to the tour, and then crashed out of the tour that year as well, didn't you?
Well, as I said on the live coverage a number of days ago, with I think it was Bohani, I said jamais deux sans trois, as the French say, never two without three. And for me, that was certainly the year, because I went to the tour, and I remember we were riding along near Portalier, and the group was riding very casually, and we were just having a general talk between riders. And of course, it was a Colombian rider who took 15, 20 riders to the ground. And there I got, really badly road rashed. And then I went on, and of course, I crashed again in the feed station. Another one of these, as we say in biking, one of these stupid crashes in the feed station, just wasn't taking attention. And a rider slowed in front of me, crashed into the back of me, and did my ligaments in my shoulder.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
Lionel was mentioning earlier how the Vuelta has changed. Obviously it changed in terms of its date in the calendar, but we read stories of the state of the Vuelta in the 1970s when the fields were fewer than 100 riders. Interest in it seemed to be flagging. There were some doubts about whether it would even carry on. Now, Spain was a very different place at the time as well, but in the 80s, I mean, the race that you see now, with, and there are huge crowds this year as well, and that's been another trend that the last few years, that the crowds have been growing. You know, it has the look of it of a Grand Tour from the outside, certainly. You know, not on the same level as a Tour, obviously, but not that far behind the Giro, perhaps. In the 80s, where did it stand, and what was the feel of the race in relation to the Tour de France at the time?
Well, I think it was of less importance, media point of view, because it was in the beginning of season. There was a lot of other races, of course. You know, the Northern Classics were around that time, so a lot of riders, you know, were taking part or just finishing the classics. Then the Giro was, just around the corner, so you know, to attract a lot of the big names and to get a big field was always difficult. But I would say Vuelta was always a race that was very well supported by the Spanish spectators and the public. To this day you can see some of the finishes, there's not a big crowd of spectators like in the Tour of France, for example. So it hasn't changed in that way, but I think it's got more importance now. You know, there's more TV coverage, more live coverage all around the world,
including on British Eurosport.
Well, thinking about at 88 when you won, one of the things that sort of has changed now, it's a much more international event now. Back in the 80s, often it was Spain versus the rest of the world, wasn't it? And it wasn't uncommon for riders from different Spanish teams to gang up to make sure that a Spaniard would win the race. I think, Richard, you know very well the story of Robert Miller losing the Vuelta in 85 when, not to put too fine a point on it, the Spaniards combined to do him over a couple of days from the end. Sean, you were riding for a Spanish team. Do you think that helped in terms of, you know, you weren't perhaps ganged up on quite so much? In 1988 when you won, you were up against a very formidable BH team, which had four or five really good Spanish climbers. The equivalent today would be, I suppose, would be Movistar, but having four or five possible winners all packed in one team, and you were up against all of them.
Yes, well, certainly riding in a Spanish outfit, Spanish sponsor, it was easier. You know, the public, the Spanish public were very supportive of CAS because it was a sponsor who went on for many, many years previous, who had been the cycling sponsorship for a long, long time. So that did help me. Also, I was aware of the problem Robert Miller had when Delgado went on to win that tour. So we were being a bit more careful, certainly. And I think when you look back in the 80s, there was a lot of Spanish riders, maybe better big two riders. If you look at BH, there was at least three riders. There was Pino, there was Anselmo Forte, and there was one or two other riders capable of, you know, winning a three-week tour. So it was a bit more difficult. But I think now it's become a much more international event, and of course, with the rankings and all of that which go with the big tours, that has, you know, made it more important also. So the teams are sending better teams. If it's a sprinters team, they're sending better sprinters, that way they can pick up some of the glory. And of course, as we mentioned some moments ago, there's so many, you know, of the big names going back to the Vuelta in the last number of years.
Sean, I think you were riding the 85 Vuelta, were you not? You rode the 85 race that Robert Miller lost to Pedro Delgado. Just briefly on that, I mean, were you... a lot of stories about what went on that day. Robert Miller was riding for a French team, Peugeot, and was in the race leader's jersey and was caught up with a puncture, got back on, by which time Delgado had escaped. It was terrible weather, I think, that day, so people were wearing rain capes. It wasn't perhaps clear who'd gone and who was a danger and all the rest of it. There was a lot of confusion. But there was also a conspiracy theory that Miller had been sort of ganged up against by the so-called Spanish Armada. Was that your impression of what happened that day?
Well, it was definitely an S day in biking. It was horrible in the beginning. Everybody, the rain coats on, so it was difficult to see the numbers when the attacks were going and breakaways going. And ganging up, I think, it's not really the word. I think lack of communication was probably the problem there. And I remember after the race, because I was in the general, but my place wasn't really of any danger. And I remember the director sportif saying, I knew the time checks weren't correct. That's what my director said after the event. And he was saying, well, Robert Miller's director sportif, he's not the sharpest tool in the toolbox.
So was this a case where they overestimated or underestimated what the gap was and gave incorrect information to you as the riders?
Yes, they underestimated the time gap, and I think that definitely the time coming back, they were much greater for Delgado out in front with Recio, a Spanish rider who was a real strong time trialist. And then
I think there were three of them in the break, weren't there? There was a Spanish TV motorbike as well.
Yes, well, that was the one we did not get the number of. Number 36 and 31, but the third number, we never received that. yes, and it did come back quite late, and I think they realised, yes, that Robert Miller's team realised that the gap was much greater. How they do that or how they got that, I do not know. And I remember Robert Miller spoke to some of my teammates. We started riding also in the end, but it was only in the final 15 kilometres, and it was too late to correct the situation, and he lost too much time, and of course lost the opportunity to win the Vuelta.
One of the great stories of that day, not sure if it was true or not, was that Miller, having been paced back to the bunch by two of his Peugeot teammates, they were just off the back of the group when a level crossing came down, which held them up, obviously. They waited at the level crossing. No train ever appeared. So the two teammates who might have been able to help him bring the gap down never rejoined the bunch, which is, it also helps to fuel the conspiracy theories. But I don't know if the Vuelta or the Spanish Armada had the Spanish train operators on site as well. I'm not sure about that.
Well, Delgado had two teammates, the motorbike and the train driver.
Right, well, listen, we should wrap it up for this week. And before we go, a quick reminder that you can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. That entitles you to access, behind our paywall, to our exclusive friends specials. There are 8 of them there now. We're working at the moment on mobile technology for those, so that you'll be able to listen to them on your mobile phone. That'll be coming very soon, we promise. There are 8 now. There are 3 more to come this year. I think we've got some exciting plans for them, haven't we, Lionel?
We have, yeah.
Great. Well,
we can't give it away just yet. Not
can maybe offer a hint, you know, a clue. It's about cycling. They're about cycling, all 3 of them.
They're all about cycling, yeah. I think you're working on one, I'm working on one, and Daniel's working on one. That's all we can say at the moment.
Yep. Okay, that's tantalising. Only £5 to access all the friend specials. There are 8 there now, as we said, and 3 more to come. So for the moment, all that remains is for me to say thank you very much to our very special guest, Sean Kelly. Sean, thank you very much for joining us. Hopefully you'll join us again at some point.
Thank you very much, and good viewing for the rest of Vuelta.
Thank you, Sean, and thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.